Welcome to News Talking. This is D.G. Martin. A fine North Carolina writer publishes numerous popular books, and then she dies, and her work is out of print. And so except for a few loyal fans, her work is forgotten, or at least that's the way it would have been for the work of Mebane Holloman Bergwin, except for the work of a determined librarian, Sarah Davis, who joins us today to talk about her project and what's happened. And welcome, Sarah Davis. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here because I really do want to promote her work.
Well, the Bergwin name, I may not be,
if I'm, Bergwin.
Bergwin name is a famous North Carolina name with, I found out, with descendants everywhere. Family goes back, I'm told, to Jonathan Edwards, in fact. And Mebane Holloman married into this distinguished North Carolina family and brought distinguished family herself. Particularly people in the legal field will know about these lawyers and
from
judges.
Judge Bergwin, yes, her father-in-law.
Family, but tell us about the author.
Well, when I first came to North Carolina, which has now been, will be 25 years ago next month, I began hearing people talk about her because I was in that part of the state where she had lived. I had heard of the boy Colonel all my life, and so knew of the name Bergwin, but had no idea who this was. And I set out to try to find out more about her.
The boy Colonel. This is a book that in that time was well known, as you'd heard about this book.
The boy Colonel was a real, young officer at Gettysburg.
All right, and what an in-law of hers is
right.
That right? Okay,
one of her, and in fact, I believe it's Bland Simpson who says in Into the Sound Country, his book. Where he's talking about the area, and he calls her his kinswoman. And like I say, I object. He was a kinsman to husband.
An in-law.
But nonetheless, the recognition is there. And in that book, Bland actually mentions...
The boy.
He mentions the boy Colonel, but he mentions her writings as well. And so I was thrilled that
Came in, you'd heard of this figure, and you started hearing about her as a writer.
Right, and I became good friends with her nieces, Anna and Margaret Bergwin. Anna is a teacher. Margaret was a counselor, as Miss Bergwin became in her later years, and Margaret was mayor of Woodland for a time, where the Bergwins lived. And so I started into research. I first tried to read the books, and that's difficult.
Why?
They're out of print.
It's difficult to get the books,
not difficult
to read them once you get them.
Oh, not at all. They're wonderful to read once you get your hands on them, but just trying to get them was difficult.
What I'd love for you to do is tell us about those books and why they were popular and maybe why they've fallen out of print.
They're children's books. She published 7 children's books in her lifetime, the first in the late 40s, the last in 1969. And she said her father was the best storyteller she ever heard, and she really began just trying sort of to preserve some of his stories. So she would tell her children bedtime stories. Later, she decided she wanted to learn to type, and she began typing those stories up after the children were in bed. Her oldest son, Johnny to all of them, John to me, named for his father, of course, says he can remember the typing, especially the return of the carriage, as we would do on those old manual typewriters. And so she had written this series of short stories, and she started trying to shop it around. She had a friend, Bernice Kelly Harris, who was a writer who encouraged her. As a matter of fact, Vaughn White Holloman, who was Mebane's mother, and Miss Harris were good friends and in a writer's group together. And Vaughn didn't drive, as some ladies didn't, and so Mebane would drive her mother over to see Bernice Kelly Harris. And so she got started sitting in on the writers' groups and so forth, and Miss Kelly, as she was known there, really encouraged Mebane to try to pursue this. So she sent her work off and was, let's see, she first went to Lippincott, and they didn't do children's books. And so they sent her to Oxford, who were interested in them, but said, we would be more interested in a novel. Don't want the short stories. And so encouraged her to put everything together into a novel. And she did put these short stories together into her first novel, which was River Treasure. And it was written for children about the ages hers were. It's a wonderful story about buried treasure. Her husband's uncle had received a letter about Burgoyne family treasure that was buried during the war between the states. And Jim Dean, who has a book of essays, visited her, took his own son there to visit, and she tells him in that, we don't know whether there ever was any treasure or not, but just that letter was enough to get her started writing this story. The story is about a young African-American boy who finds this treasure. And because of the difficulty of getting those books, I didn't read them in order. And so I didn't read River Treasure first about this young African-American. The second one that she published a couple of years later in 49 was Lucky Mischief, which was also about a young African-American boy. The first one that I read was actually the last one she published, Crackerjack Pony. Crackerjack Pony is also about a young African-American boy. Well, I was reading along and well into the book when I encountered this description of this young boy coming toward main character, and he mentions that he bristled as he always did when a white boy appeared. I'm thinking, what? And I back up.
Oh, you didn't know he was an African-American.
I had no idea from the reading. I backed up and I reread, and no, wasn't there. I reread again. I mean, I thought, I'm not reading any better, and I've complained about other people reading here. It simply wasn't there. When you turn the page after where I was, you see an illustration that will tell you these were Dale Payson's illustrations, that yes, this was indeed an African-American youngster. Had I read those first two novels first, I might have been better prepared for Crackerjack Pony being about an African-American, but I wasn't.
So you were, I mean, this is something that people mention about her work, is that she was able to write in the Deep South, write about race, about different boys of white or African-American without a racial overlay on.
Absolutely.
That
they're just boys. And in fact, that's what one reviewer said, that that's what she does. And in coming across the reviews of the time, because again, there's just as the primary material is difficult to get, the secondary material is just not there. What you end up with are contemporary reviews or something like that. And in reading these reviews of the earlier ones, you come across this, except for the illustrations, you would never know that these were African-American children. The Burgoyne family lived out on Ockanechee Neck.
And you'll have to tell the Chapel Hill folks where where this is, if you can.
Well, it's near Jackson.
Well, you're going to still have to do better than that.
Okay, going out 158, if you go up across the top of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And
along
out,
close to the Virginia line.
Exactly. And out where Halifax, Northampton counties,
so
Hartford
getting
counties.
Close to the coast, but not quite into the Sound country, into Bland Simpson's country.
Right, exactly. Going out that way. But it's just off 158, and it's very fertile ground. In the beginning of River Treasure, she has a wonderful description of this Ockanechee Neck. And the family lived there and farmed. And when they lived there, they were one of three white families out there. At one time, they were the only white family on the neck. And so, as Roy Parker said in the Fayetteville Observer, after she died, when he was writing a tribute to her, what she did was just to describe those characters that she knew, the ones that were around her. And in that case, they were these young African-American
wow.
children. She does it with tremendous dignity. Ezra Jack Keats on Snowy Day was held up for doing this, that he was the first one to present an African-American just as a regular child.
Well,
but she had been doing it for years.
Now, you bring Jack Keats in, and you're going to have to tell us who he is.
Ezra Jack Keats is probably best known to most people for two things. One is the little short story, The Snowy Day, a children's story about a young African-American child and has the Snowy Day holiday. But he's also known because in his early years, he was a cartoonist working with Marvel Comics.
And the connection with Mebbin is that he gets credit for this, and she ought to share some of this credit.
Absolutely, because it was, I guess, 15 years before he did that she had done this.
Wow.
And in fact, something about the author, one of the few places you can find something about him, does have the information about her where it holds him up as being the first, but it has the information about her doing these characters so beautifully. In fact, I think it was Margaret Stamthurst in writing about her for the Raleigh News and Observer back in the 40s and 50s that said she is as indigenous to North Carolina and her characters are as indigenous to North Carolina as the longleaf pine, that's what she's doing is just describing what she saw.
Well, before we take a break, I just emphasize that while we live in a different time, but in the times that she was writing where the racial issues were developing not only as a sort of a challenge to the Southern way of life, she was presenting the Southern way of life in a different context of equality might not be the right word, but of all boys being boys.
It's exactly.
Kind of a equality and sameness rather than emphasizing the characteristics of difference that seem to be emphasized in much of literature.
Very much so.
Well, we're talking with Sarah Davis about her work on North Carolina author Mebbin Holloman Bergwin, and she and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Sarah Davis, and we're talking about a North Carolina author whom many people have forgotten about. But Sarah Davis is not going to let us forget about Mebbin Holloman Bergwin. And Sarah, your project has come to the attention of a wider audience because of an article you've written for the North Carolina Literary Review and the publication in the review of a previously unpublished story by Mebbin Holloman Bergwin. And I wonder if you'd tell us the story of this story.
Well, in doing my research about Mrs. Bergwin, I first went to Chapel Hill because that's where I thought her papers were, mistakenly, but went to the archives there. And fortunately, ran into someone because when I went up, the first person I asked said, "Oh, you want Judge Bergwin's papers?" No. Who knew enough to say, "Go get her Dick Walzer's papers." And so Dick Walzer, who was at NC State and did a great deal with literature there and the North Carolina writers and so forth, had his collection is at Chapel Hill, and I was able to find a great deal about her looking at his papers.
Why is that? Why were his papers instructive?
Because he kept everything that ever was in relationship to, I think, most of North Carolina literature. But in the particular section I was able to pull out about her, he had all of these contemporary reviews of her works, correspondence that he had, even a Christmas card that she had sent him and said, "John and I want you to come out to Woodland and we'll promise you pheasant for Christmas dinner, if you will." He had a write-up of her daughter's wedding. Just anything about her he had, but as I said, most of it did pertain to her literature. But I then found out that her papers are actually at UNCG. She was a student there when it was Woman's College. And so when the time came that she wanted to make some disposition of some of her papers, she gave them to the library there. After her death, the family needed to do something with what remained, and after considerable discussion as to whether or not they would go to Chapel Hill or to Greensboro, they determined, well, Mother had put them in Greensboro, and that's obviously where she wanted them. They also have a very good collection with in their archives for children's literature, and so it was very appropriate that they go there. So in the summer of 2004, with limited time to do it, I went to the library there, and they brought out a very neat little package that were the papers she had given them. They have been cataloged, recorded, etc., and you can find a great deal in them. But they also brought these two huge boxes that the family had given later, the late 90s. She died in 92, and somewhere in the late 90s, the family went through, they thought, and found everything they wanted and said, okay, the rest of these can be placed in the library in Greensboro. They have not had the opportunity yet to do the same with them. They had the first ones, and they said, here. Well, I kept allowing myself just a few more minutes to see what I could find. I was able to find some very interesting things in those papers in addition to this story that I discovered right at the end. For instance, I found a number of different titles that they were apparently trying out for River Treasure, and just a page with all of them listed, and you could see checkoffs and this kind of thing. I also found something that, for me, was very interesting, and I think actually became interesting for her youngest son, Steve. In Dick Walzer's comments about her in some of the books, on, such as Tar Heel Authors, he mentions that she wrote for children the ages of her own, with her books advancing, like when you read River Treasure, it's written for a 10-year-old. And then you get up to the teen years, when her daughter was a teenager and she's writing some girls' books by then. And he said, reversing this with her last publication, Crack-A-Jack Pony, after all her children were grown. Well, what I found in those papers where I'm just rumbling through was the beginning of Crack-A-Jack Pony. And it was begun when the main character, who's about 10 in that one, as the one in River Treasure, at the time that her youngest son would have been about 10. But it's about that time that she goes back to school to become a counselor and so forth, and so the writing went on the back burner for several years. So, yes, Steve was grown by the time she actually finished Crack-A-Jack Pony and published it, but she was obviously still doing exactly the same thing when she started it, writing for a child about her age. But finally, my son was at a coach's conference over at the Coliseum in Greensboro, and I knew I had to go get him. Time was running out on me. I said, okay, five more minutes, and I saw this very thin folder that I thought, I can look at this. And when I looked at it and pulled it out, I realized that I actually had something in my hands, because I had a story. The paper clip had rusted through on it. And these wonderful drawings. She also was an artist. And in colored pencils, she had done drawings for a story that had actually two different title pages. One was A Party Dress for Elsa, and the other was Tanny. But the family always calls it Tanny when they talk about it. So I looked at it and thought, this is the most wonderful thing I've ever seen, and I've never seen this in any of the published writings. What is this? What can I do with it?
Well, what was the story that you found?
It is the story of, it's a fairy story, and it's very different from her other writing.
This is not set in eastern North Carolina. This could
be anywhere. It's about a little girl who is named Katie, and Katie just doesn't quite behave as Katie should sometimes. And so there is the story of this fairy who wants to go to the king's ball, and she needs a dress to go to the king's ball. She wants a yellow dress. And one of the beautiful things about Ms. Burguin's writing is her descriptions. You see them. You taste. You feel when you read her imagery. And that's very much in this, even though it's not like the rest of the writings, where she talks about the beautiful yellow of the sun. Tanny says, you have no yellow material? Will there be no yellow dresses at the ball? No, there is no yellow dye this year. I tried to get some from the sun, but he had so many daffodils to color that he could not spare any. I'm sorry, for the party will not be so pretty without yellow dresses. Well, Tanny wants to go to the party, and she wants a yellow dress. And she's the youngest fairy out there, and it's kind of like earning the wings on for the angel in It's a Wonderful Life. She's got to do something to earn her place. So she has to help little Katie.
This is a little sort of bad girl, Katie, but a nice girl. I mean, a good girl, but just, needs a little discipline.
She doesn't quite have the manners that she needs. She doesn't wait at the table to start eating when she should. And so Tanny makes her drop her fork. And by the time she retrieves it and is back up at the table, it's time for her to begin eating and things like that. And so she manages to get Katie to do the things that Katie should, but she's got to get Katie in the habit of doing them on her own. That's what's really got to come through. And finally, of course, Katie does it enough that she does on her own do what she's supposed to. And Katie's mother has this beautiful yellow dress that she's then willing to give Tanny some of the material so that Tanny can have this most beautiful dress. And Tanny gets to go to the ball, and there Tanny is seen by the prince, and the prince falls in love and marries her. And so Katie has a fairy godmother and a fairy godfather, Prince Dorn and Princess Tanny, who do look after her forever and ever. And they do it because Katie's heart was happy, and the reason her heart was happy was because she was always doing things for others.
Well,
and Katie lived happily ever after, just as do Tanny and Prince Dorn. When I found the story, I called the family members, began calling the children and saying, I have this. And I was very excited, and I wasn't quite getting the excitement level that they had. I wanted some way to publish this. I immediately am saying, you know, how can we do this? And so finally it was explained to me that they were thrilled that I had found this story, especially the only daughter, Jo, because it had been a favorite story of hers as a child. And she now says she thinks there's a reason her mother wrote it for her. That it was
looking back,
yes,
she
might have been Katie. And it had just been a very special one. It was one that they thought they had taken out of the papers. Because, like I said,
this was something they had probably would have wanted to have saved.
Exactly.
But they didn't, and therefore,
it was
a great part of the story.
And so, because like I say, not only did you have her as the writer, you also had her as the artist preserved here. And so I knew that this issue was
coming
up.
We're talking about the North Carolina Literary Review, which is, by the way, one of North Carolina's great assets. It's a journal like magazine about North Carolina writers and literature, but it's so peppy and full of illustrations and photographs that it's easy for anybody to read. It ought to be a bestseller. In any event, that's where you decided to go to get this published.
Right. And we do need to pay tribute to Dr. Bauer, Dr. Margaret Bauer, who's editor. This is published at East Carolina University, and she does a marvelous job with it. But I knew in the fall of 2004 that the 2006 issue was to be on writers of children's lit, and so began thinking, I knew their deadline would be sometime in the summer of 2005. So I contacted Jo Burgoyne Pratt, the daughter to whom this story had been so special, and said, I think there's a way we might be able to get it published. Is it okay? I won't do anything the family doesn't want. If you say no, I'll understand. But I really think I want to give this story to the world. We need to do this.
What did you find is the legal status of such papers that are not unpublished papers by famous people whose papers are in a public archive? Are they publishable, or did you just not have to wrestle with that question since you got the family's permission?
I am not entirely sure.
Yeah.
Everything I read became more confusing.
Right.
And I think that it probably in many ways is up to the place that is holding them. Once the family has signed them over, and the family had signed all these over, I think that UNCG could have probably said, it's up to us now. But I don't think they would have either. I think they wanted the family's permission, and Dr. Bauer certainly wanted the family's permission before trying to proceed with
it. So everybody wound up really infected by your enthusiasm for this to give it a try to share it with others. So you didn't have to face the legal questions.
Exactly. Eventually. Actually, at that time, Joe did not respond. It was an email. And so I took her non-response to be a no. But, and as I said, I knew the deadline was in the file, or late summer, and I just let it go. And along in October, out of the blue one day, John, the oldest child, called me to see if I had done anything else more with research on mother. And I said, well, since you've mentioned it. And so I said, let me contact Dr. Bauer and see if there would still be any possibility. And so there began the involved process of getting the family's permission, getting the papers from UNCG. And I had given a talk on her at a symposium that was held in her honor in the September of 2004. And that rather long talk
became the
basis for the article that's the introduction to her.
Oh, wow. Well, let's take a quick break. I'm talking to Sarah Davis, and we're talking about the wonderful article that Sarah wrote for the North Carolina Literary Review about North Carolina author Mebane Holloman Burguin. And Sarah Davis, and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. Sarah Davis, I interrupted you as you were telling us the story of how you got this wonderful fairy, previously unpublished fairy story published as a part of the North Carolina Literary Review. And so tell us more.
Well, as I was saying, I did contact the family and the Dr. Margaret Bauer, editor of North Carolina Literary Review, and was back and forth between her and them in getting everything settled about it. Because there are two title pages, that became one of the concerns. The one that says A Party Dress for Elsa has the same illustrations on it as the other one. The one that says Tanny doesn't but have any illustrations, but it's obvious they are the same story. But Elsa never appears in the story, so we don't know whether Elsa was to have been another character, or maybe this was even another story she once thought about and got that far. But the family said that it was always Tanny to them, and so after some negotiating back and forth, it is published just as Tanny. Also, when you look at the story, you can see her own penciled corrections, which I was able to find in going through all the papers. You see all of the work that she did.
Right. This is the, I guess, the common problem that you have when you're setting about publishing a work by an author who's deceased and who had not had it published in his or her lifetime, is what changes would they have made, if any, and should you make them if you think they would have, and what clues? And how did you approach, what rules did you make for yourself in terms of deciding how you would edit a work when you couldn't consult with the author about it?
Well, what Dr. Bauer did was just to take her corrections, just to say that this would have been the final thing that she was doing. For instance, here's a comment. Tanny sat listening to the fairies who chattered gaily. And rather than that progressive tense, she has marked out listening and just had listened. And so rather than sat listening, it's Tanny listened to the fairies who chattered gaily. And that, I think, basically was just the rule that was used, was let's go with what she had written in as being the definitive way that she would have wanted it published. And that's the way that it appears in the NCLR.
Well, Sarah Davis, is your interest in her work primarily for history's sake, or is there a feeling in your mind that these stories, both the story the fairy tale story mm-hmm. that's published in this issue of the North Carolina Literary Review and the now out of print books, have something to say for children today? Or if the times change so much so that you can't bring them back?
I hope not. I really feel that they are universal. As I said, the fairy story is not set in northeastern North Carolina, even though the others are. But I think that what applies to northeastern North Carolina does apply at other places as well.
Well, I agree with that. But in northeastern North Carolina today, story set, I mean, you're a librarian, so you watch the reading habits or the reading, what kids like to read about today. And they don't watch the same television programs that we watched. I guess generally they read very few of the same children's books, but some are classics. I guess the question is, are these Ms. Bergwin's books classics that can be resurrected and with us for a long time if we push hard enough, or are they ones that that scholars should study so that they should know what good writers were writing about back in those days? What's your thinking?
Oh, a little of both. Definitely there's a place for it. And again, when you see what she did, when you think about what a pioneer she was, and let me just say, she was this in her life, not just as a writer, to have gone there, Tokunichi Neck, with her husband farming, must have taken a tremendous just fortitude at times on her part to be down there. But she was a member of the UNC Board of Trustees at the time the unified system was being considered. Bill Friday describes her as a tremendous lady. And it is interesting that everyone from her daughter-in-law, think about that, to someone like Bill Friday have that, you know, that she was such a genteel lady description of her always. But she was very strong and definitely was able to help people in many ways with that strength. And she fought hard for that unified system. She also was a opponent of the speaker ban and was involved in that.
So on the right side of all the causes. Huh?
Absolutely.
At least looking back.
And a great proponent for quality medical care in northeastern North Carolina and for everyone. She, as a counselor, she became the first counselor in the Northampton County Public Schools and then became director of counseling for all of Northampton County Public Schools. And, of course, when she first went into it, it was a segregated system. But she fought very hard for equality for everyone and for bond issues. And Roy Parker brings all this up in his article about her in the Fayetteville Observer, that she definitely was
wow,
in many ways seemingly ahead of her times there. But with the writing, I know that she wrote four books for boys and three for girls, and she said that was economic reasons. Girls would read boys' books. Boys wouldn't necessarily read girls' books. And the first one that I read of the girls' books, I felt like took me back to my own undergraduate days, because it's set for an undergraduate who, and it is her most autobiographical one. She is, the main character in the story is threatened with having to drop out of school. And she is rescued by an African-American friend of the family who has managed to save a lot of money through the years and is able to make a loan that allows her to go back to college. This was apparently also the case for Mebbin. In the Depression, her father, when she was at UNCG, then Women's College, her father had some business reverses. But there was a character named Sam who was a family, well, the character in the novel is Sam, and there was a family friend, Sam. Again, both cases African-American, who was able to help her in returning to school. But in just reading about the college of that day and thinking about the college of my day.
Took you back in time.
Took me back in time. She, among the only works that she published that were adult works, were two essays published at the request, written at the request of the North Carolina Medical Journal. After she was diagnosed with cancer, they asked her to do an article detailing her recovery, her treatment through the chemo and all this. And it's just, it's a wonderful article. And she goes from the diagnosis and how she felt and so forth. But there's all this humor that's in it. She tells about that in being carried to the hospital, she was carried in the hearse. Well, where I grew up in rural West Tennessee, the funeral home also provided the ambulance, which was what this case was. You've got the hearse and the ambulance are one and the same. And she tells that she was in need of a bedpan on her way to the hospital. I believe they were taking her to Roanoke Rapids to the hospital at the time. And there wasn't one, but her sister-in-law, who was riding with her, managed to find something in the hearse that would do.
That would work.
And the funeral director told her that forever thereafter, he made sure there was a bedpan. But she said she didn't know what use most of his occupants had of it. But nonetheless, that he had it. Well, like I say, this is for me. I grew up in an area where this was very much the same, which would be very strange to many people reading it today. And I recognize that. But I think that the overall truths of what she tells in the stories are still there so much for anyone that I think that children today, if I can just get them into it, away from the video game and this kind of thing, and into that, would really enjoy it.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. I'm talking to Sarah Davis about Mebane Holman Bergwin, and Sarah Davis, and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. Sarah Davis has done a lot of work about a person who's now a little known but highly respected North Carolina author, Mebane Holman Bergwin. Am I saying that right now? Or what's the best way to say the name?
Bergwin.
Bergwin. What you've done is to, through a lot of research and effort, you've gotten an unpublished story published, and you've written for a wider audience about this woman who you think is more important than the current generation's given credit for. One of the problems with this is the unavailability of her work. They're out of print. And surely you've wrestled with the question of how are we going to get these back in print, and what obstacles do you face? Is there a chance that we'll see these back in print?
I hope so. I think that her children would like to see them back in print. And let me take one quick second here to say that getting to know her family. I already knew her nieces, Margaret and Anna, but I have gotten to know her children through all this. There's John is the oldest. He lives in Whitaker's. Then the next child is Jo, the only daughter, and she now divides her time between Asheville and Florida. Had been in Connecticut. And she is a sculptor herself, very talented. The next child is Henry, who's a lawyer in Raleigh, and then Steve, who actually lives on the farm place in Ocoeneechee Neck. And they are all absolutely wonderful. And I feel like, as I have, even though I never knew her personally, that she probably fits that description that Jacqueline Kennedy had said about children, that if, no matter what else she did, First Lady or whatever, if she failed with her children, it was for naught. And I think that Mebane would probably have felt the writing was for nothing if she had failed with the children,
but
having known those children, I can say that she would be very proud. And I'm so pleased about the way they have dealt with me with all this. I just hope we really are that if through such a publication as this, we can get enough interest up, because that's the thing, is just to get the demand out there. And I hope that we will be able to have some reprinting of some of them.
Do you have to go back to the original publisher to get it, or does the family now have the rights if they can find the publisher to do it? How do you go about this?
Well, her publisher was Oxford and then Lippincott, so not difficult at all, to go back to them. We are not enough years, of course, past her death or even past the first publications for these to be in public domain. So it would take both the original publishers, who I don't think are usually interested in. In fact, I think she had tried in her lifetime to get some republished, and they just this was not the interest at that time. But I think that with their permission, which I think would probably be fairly easy to grant, and if the children want
so this, the at least as it appears, the challenge is to find a publisher who's willing to take this on as a business proposition based on the excitement generated by your work and your article, the seminars that you've had, and again, the discovery of a previously unpublished children's fairy tale story that is a part of the newest issue of the North Carolina Literary Review. All this is due to Sarah Davis, who's been here to tell us about an author that we didn't know about before, Mebane Holdeman Bergwin. Thanks to you, Sarah Davis. Thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.